This is the Back Porch Education Podcast. Today on the show, David Kern from the CERTSI Institute takes my seat and discusses education podcasts with Steve. Enjoy the show and the poem.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. And today, Jason is away from us, but I've brought in an old friend, David Kern, who, guess what? Jason has made bring a poem with him. So, David, what do you have for us?
All right. So I have a poem by a poet named Seamus Heaney. You've probably heard of him before. This is a poem called Blackberry Picking. He has a new collection that his family is putting out through FSG and comes out this month, actually. And they kind of curated some poems that were especially beloved to them from all his different collections. And the idea of the collection is that it kind of represents his whole career. It was an idea that he had had before he passed away 6 years ago. I believe it was 6 years ago. And I've read this poem on a podcast that I do called The Daily Poem, but it's one of my favorite poems. And when you mentioned it, I thought it's a great poem for this time of year because the first two words are late August. So
well, there we go.
Recording in late August, it seemed like the right time. So should I just dive right in then?
Go for it, sir.
All right. So this is Blackberry Picking by Seamus Heaney. Late August, given heavy rain and sun for a full week, the blackberries would ripen. At first, just one, a glossy purple clot among others, red, green, hard as a knot. You ate that first one, and its flesh was sweet like thickened wine. Summer's blood was in it, leaving stains upon the tongue and lust for picking. Then red ones inked up, and that hunger sent us out with milk cans, pea tins, jam pots, where briars scratched and wet grass bleached our boots. Round hayfields, cornfields, and potato drills, we trekked and picked until the cans were full, until the tinkling bottom had been covered with green ones, and on top, big dark blobs burned like a plate of eyes. Our hands were peppered with thorn pricks, our palms sticky as bluebeards. We hoarded the fresh berries in the byre, but when the bath was filled, we found a fur, a rat-gray fungus glutting in our cache. The juice was stinking too. Once off the bush, the fruit fermented. The sweet flesh would turn sour. I always felt like crying. It wasn't fair that all the lovely canfuls smelt of rot. Each year I hoped they'd keep. Knew they would not. So that's Blackberry Picking by Seamus Heaney.
Or well, thank you.
Heaney, I guess.
Yeah, well, the accent takes a little work, right?
Right.
Thank you for reading that for us and for choosing that. Followers of our podcast know that Jason and I spend a lot of time comparing factory model with farm model in education. Hmm. So anytime we get metaphors of the farm on the podcast, we get kind of excited about that. So
yeah,
thank you. And I've invited you on today because podcasting is a significant part of what you do with the CERTSI Institute, but mm-hmm. wanted to give you a chance first today just to tell a little bit about who you are and maybe something about CERTSI and then kind of segue into what CERTSI's doing with podcasting before we get on further than that.
Sure. Well, I joined our little endeavor here kind of officially right when I finished college because my dad needed some help. For those of you who don't know, my dad, Andrew Kern, is another old friend of yours. And he started the CERTSI Institute, you know, as kind of a, I don't know, he was working on a book and doing some consulting back in the day and needed an organization. So to kind of, I guess as a, for tax purposes. And so he formed the CERTSI Institute, and it was mainly him for a while, and he would put on conferences, and when I was in high school he was doing that, and my, you know, I was helping out, so I was kind of around the world, and I liked the people that were involved and the books that were involved. So when I finished college, I needed a job, he needed some help, so I came on. And this was you know, more than a decade ago now, or I guess maybe around a decade ago now. And podcasts back in 2009 were certainly not what they are now. But I was listening to some people who were sports podcasters and movie podcasters. So I was, you know, I was kind of, I was kind of aware of their existence. And I thought, I don't know, man, we could do something like that. Andrew Kern's got a few followers, so we could have him host some conversations or put some of his conference lectures on there and do some things like that. And so when we were kind of trying to expand some of the things that we were offering, that seemed like a good thing to try. I mean, there wasn't any risk at the time, you know, was me and him. And, you know, occasionally we'd bring in some guests and we started doing interviews and it just kind of took off from there. At first there was just one show called Quiddity, and Quiddity was the name of my dad's blog at the time. And so we thought, let's take that name and make it our podcast. And sometimes he and I would chat about something. Sometimes he and some of his friends would. We gradually brought on more people on staff and it just kind of grew as conversations out of that. And like I said, we started doing interviews. And now we've got two different networks and 8 or 9 shows with plans to launch 4 or 5 more shows over the next year with various different partners out there, you know, other organizations and people who are doing good work. But, you know, we have some infrastructure for the podcasting thing in terms of hosting them and editing them and stuff like that. So we can, you know, work with people on that. And that's really exciting. My favorite part is the collaboration of podcasts. We do podcasts that are on literature, such as our Close Reads podcast. And the best part is just talking to people, you know. I get to interview a lot of people like you do and have these conversations. And that's the exciting part that makes podcasting so interesting. You know, it's obviously hit a boom. And I guess we kind of got in at the right time to have at least, I mean, we don't have an audience like the really big podcasters do, but within our niche kind of education world, it's fun to kind of have a niche and be able to have these conversations with people. And it started as kind of just something we tried, you know, see if it works. And it worked enough to keep doing it at any rate. So we'll do that until it doesn't work anymore, I suppose.
Well, it certainly seemed reproductive as a watcher of Searcy and sometime podcast listener. It's just like, I can't keep up with all the episodes. Yeah. So you guys are proliferating, and I guess that means that it's finding an ear. People are requesting things and willing to come on and talk and that sort of thing. So
yeah, it's kind of a fine line though, right? Like, because at a certain point you can create too much content, and even your most loyal listeners can only keep up with so much. So that's where things like, I think the seasonal podcast have been really, I've been a really interesting evolution in podcast, and I find myself listening more and more to seasonal stuff, you know, especially in of the narrative variety or that are touching on a specific topic. There's certain, you know, comfort food podcasts that I like that I'm just glad that I have that person or that show in my life that I can listen to every week for a half hour or something. But to really make the most of it, the seasonal podcasting, I think, has been the biggest, the best sort of evolution in the genre, in the media, because you can tell a story or have discussions about something specific or think about a specific theme over, say, 5 to 10 episodes. And, you know, you do 5 to 10 weeks and then you can have a new season. So you don't have to have all the podcasts running at the same time. You can offer people great content, but in, you know, I don't like to use the word bite-sized because it's sort of, it suggests that there's not a lot to chew on, but, you know, you can do them in fewer episodes in a way that doesn't put as much a strain on people's schedules or you know, there's only, even the worst commute is only so long, right?
Right, right. Well, and that's an interesting thing to me. Somebody mentioned to me here a while back that they felt like podcasting might be the new library, and that there's individuals, some are just coming in to read the latest news, so to speak, over in the periodical section, and others are really hobbyists, you know, they're listening, as you mentioned, there's a lot of sports podcasts. I have a son that follows UFC stuff. And so he listens to these people. And then there's the people that are trying to educate themselves on something. And I think that's sort of the section of the library we kind of fall in. And Back Porch has had this conversation in a 30 to 45 minute moment. There's a certain amount we're willing to cover for the general public. that's led us to something still fairly new for us. In fact, it's not functioning yet, but it's in the works, and we keep promising it to our listeners.
Which we've got to keep promising porch. Stuff.
Right. That's, yes. Sell. The side porch notion, where, for instance, the first thing is this past summer, now ending, I put in a lot of hours and wound up with about 10 hours of material on a history of education in Western civilization. Hmm. We've talked a lot about historical education and how it fits into things, but the average listener doesn't want to work through that. So we're going to put it over on the side, and if it interests them, they can go access it, but it's not like we're foisting it upon them through our, if you want to listen to our podcast, you got to listen to Elliot's 8 hours on history. So yeah. I think that's one of the great benefits of podcasting, is that it's flexible. Yeah. And, you know, what's his name? Mike Rowe has like a 7-minute podcast that I'm addicted to. So, then the biggest podcaster in the world, Joe Rogan, goes on for an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you listen to like one of Mark Maron's interviews or something with celebrities, and they're talking, the podcast goes for an hour and a half, and the first 15 minutes is him just talking about whatever's on his mind or whatever he wants to vent about. And then you get an interview with somebody and there's an ad read in there somewhere. And, you know, I think in some ways, early on people like that because there's this sort of sense that they're like your friend, you know, like you kind of just settle in with them for a while. And there was this, I remember, there's a guy named sports podcaster named Bill Simmons. He's one of the biggest, certainly in the world, in the sports world anyway. And early on, he worked for ESPN, and they were like, you have to do these 20-minute podcasts. That's all people are going to sit for. And he's like, no, my listeners are going to, they want to spend time. They want to hear stuff. They want to hear these long conversations. So he was one of the, you know, early pioneers in saying, let's do these long conversations. And I think that worked especially early on because it made people feel like you're friends with them, or you're just kind of hanging out and lingering and, you know, the long commute or the long train ride where, you know, it helps you with that. But more than that, it made you feel like you were friends with the person, because when you hear someone talk for an hour, you really get to know them. Whereas if you listen to like that segment on Fresh Air and you hear them talk to Terry Gross for 10 minutes, you might learn something, but you don't really feel like you're getting to know them. It's going to be interesting to see though, over the next 5 years, are those long podcasts, if people try to get in now, starting with long podcasts, is that going to be difficult for them to get in because so many listeners kind of have their one or two people who, you know, produce these long podcasts every week, and there's just not room for any more of those. And so
right.
The short, addictive, punchy podcasts are the ones that are going to catch on, and maybe you're going to have the seasonal stuff like what Malcolm Gladwell is doing or something like that, where your commitment is, you know, 30 minutes, 10 or 11 times, and then you don't have, then it's not again for a few months. And that's going to allow people to consume more stuff. I just think it's going to be harder and harder for people to do what Joe Rogan or Bill Simmons or Mark Maron is going to do. I think the fact that they got in so early was crucial to their success. And if someone was trying to do that now, it's, I don't know if I would say it's impossible, but it must be really hard unless you're already really famous.
Yeah, it's interesting the comment earlier about it being a library, and then hearing you talk, it's a lot about relationship. Mm-hmm. So when I go to a bookstore or a library, I've got my authors that I just, you know, what do they have of Wendell Berry's here, you know, or something like that. I just check it out.
Someone I've read, I want to check the other title. Yeah.
Yeah. Do they have anything I don't have or whatnot? And it's just like you have to check in. And so there is a relational aspect to it that I think is a little different. I mean, radio, I guess, has some of that where people get in a routine of listening to so-and-so on my way to work or whatnot. But the podcast, of course, has a more flexible nature in that it's recorded, so you don't have to tune in or miss them.
The fact that you had to be in the car next to your radio at a certain time meant that relationship was still... it's somewhat limited, like, because you could go, if you're on vacation, you're going to go a whole week, you're going to miss it. And then every day. And then you're going to come back after that week of being gone, and they're going to be referencing all those things that they talked about in the previous week, or it's going to be tied to the news or whatever. And so the fact that you get to go and choose when you listen, that you have some agency in it, and the choices that you make almost enhances the relational aspect of it, I think.
There's a sense that it's like what Netflix brought to the TV watching experience. I can binge on a podcast. If I find a new one that I really like and there's 30 episodes, I can shoot through that boy just as fast and as long as my time and schedule allows.
Yeah, exactly. When you're mowing the lawn or running.
Yeah, I've discovered that there's times, depending on the podcast. Now, if it's sort of more along the line of ear candy and I'm just kind of, I don't want to say entertaining, but don't have to overly concentrate, then it's cool. But like, I had an interesting experience at the gym on the treadmill with Philosophize This, and he's making some point that I'm thinking really hard about. I nearly killed myself because I wasn't concentrating on what's going on physically.
The recipe for disaster.
Yes, yes. There is this distraction that we keep talking about that that makes me think carefully about what I listen to in the car and that sort of thing. I don't want to die because I was listening to a really intense podcast. There's better ways to
ideally.
Go.
Also probably worse.
Yeah, there probably are worse, but I would prefer it to be less embarrassing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, fair. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So if folks haven't figured it out, you listen to a fair amount of podcasts yourself. I'm not going to make you tell me a number, but I'm assuming you've done, especially in working with the Searcy podcast, sort of a decent amount of looking around at what's in the educational niche. And Jason and I at least have taken, and of course, you made a statement early on that your dad had a following and thus the podcast got followers. And that struck me as somewhat important to Jason and I, because we don't have any followers. And that appears to be the key to this enterprise. But niche followers, people that are trying to know more about, in our case, education. What have you found that I'm certainly going to let you come back around and tell us a little bit more about what Searcy is offering and how folks can find it and that sort of thing. But what have you found out there that you would hold up as useful, helpful, beautiful, educational podcast?
Oh man. Well, how narrowly do you want me to think about the concept of an educational podcast?
Oh, because now a Kern has to go and get philosophical on me.
Well, no. I just mean like, you know, there's history podcasts, for example, but you know, you're learning history and they're pretty educational. Like,
right.
You learn a lot from them.
Let's stick to the art of teaching.
Okay.
Podcasts that are focused on the teacher's life and mind and resources and that sort of thing.
You know, it's funny that you ask this because I was just thinking, I was just thinking that in my opinion, really, really good education podcast is one of the areas where there's, I think it's an area that's lacking actually.
Okay. I knew you were either going to say it's overly full or greatly lacking.
Can it be both? Because I think there are a lot of podcasts, well, there are a decent number of podcasts out there in education, and I think a lot of them are lacking in terms of quality. I think there are a lot of podcasts where you can learn just like, for example, how to study Spanish, right?
Okay, yeah.
But I don't think that there are a lot that are doing a good job of diving into the like actual educational philosophy or into pedagogy that are thinking about it in a way that's, you know, challenging and isn't sort of speaking to a specific niche choir, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, so let me modify the question then and say, in your mind, what would a great education podcast seek to do?
I think on the one hand, it has to model, both good teaching and both learning, both good teaching and good learning. I think that one of the things about when you talk about, you know, the reason I asked you is it need to be more specific than just say literature or history or something, because those can show you how to teach or learn that subject matter, but it gives you something of an entryway in that's in some ways easier than being a podcast that's just about the concept of pedagogy, because when you're talking about the concept of teaching or pedagogy or classroom management or whatever it is, that's kind of an inherently dry thing for most people. So making it entertaining can be challenging. And so that entryway through a subject matter is, I think, pretty crucial in terms of helping people sort of being able to incarnate the ideas that you'd be talking about in to educational philosophy or podcasts about pedagogy. So I think you, if you're going to do it without the entryway of the subject matter, you have to find a way to do what that subject matter does for those podcasts. And a lot of times I think that's going to be conversation, but then it's hard to model what looks like in a classroom. I'm not as big a fan of a podcast that's just going to kind of give you a list of pieces of advice to do.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you're going to be a teacher, teach this thing. Like it needs to ask difficult questions of teachers and challenge them and cause them to think about sort of the norms that they're accepting for teaching. Even if it's just about classical education, say, which is the area that, you know, Cersei's involved in. Hopefully the Cersei podcasts are not just preaching to the classical education niche choir. Hopefully they're also asking us to think deeply about the definitions that we're using. And the conversations that we're having are not just trying to get information from a guest, but we're also trying to learn more ourselves. We're trying to discover more about classical education and what the definitions can be, like not be too set on one specific sort of definition. And so I think a lot of times educational podcasts and education books and things like that are just about sort of speaking to a specific choir and figuring out how do you pass on, you know, the thing that everyone agrees in the most efficient way possible. Yeah, everybody in that kind of niche believes in something. So the book's just about how do we disseminate that more widely. And I think that's sort of ultimately not going to last. And those conversations aren't going to be as meaningful.
Well, and I think it almost confused the conversation because when you're trying to formulate something, it's more of a science as a discrete set of knowledge and teaching's an art. So you've kind of went in the wrong door, right? You're trying to explain how to do something to someone when, as you're saying, the modeling and the example is the all. I hope, you know, our attempt at a podcast is that of a conversation. We really think conversation can make a difference in the world. And Jason and I used to sit on my back porch and have conversations. And when he decided to leave North Carolina for his home state of Missouri, and I was done beating him with a stick, I said, well, I've got to talk to you, man. I can't just give up on this conversation. It's great stuff. And at some points, one of us said, well, we could do a podcast. And for us, that's what it's been is, you know, we do try and stick to an idea, but we ramble all over the place in our small little listenership. If they're loyal to us, it's because they somehow like that rambling rather than I'm going to plug in, download information and go on my happy way, more efficiently equipped to do this thing. We hope it's a change of heart. We hope it's a growth of the mind and soul rather than just a information download.
I don't think that there's a way to have a good conversation if you are not reserving room for the rabbit trails.
Yep.
I think that that's sort of one of the inherent characteristics to a good conversation. So if in a podcast or even a classroom conversation or whatever kind of conversation it is, if you're not reserving room for that or allowing for that to happen, then you're not, then I think you're kind of, maybe you're missing the point of conversation.
Well, my students enjoy when they don't know me well, I see in their eyes, because I've been doing this a while, the delight of maybe we can get him off topic by introducing some rabbit trail.
Yeah.
And over time they get frustrated. I don't think frustrated is the right term. They get foiled with the fact that, doggone it, Elliot thinks everything has to do with everything. And so somehow the conversation can't be taken somewhere he doesn't mind going. And that is the fun of conversation, is that when when I have a good conversation and then try and go back over in my mind the road traveled, it's not A to B, at least not in a straight line. It's a wandering thing, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
It's interesting because when I interview people about books they've written or something like that, I don't send them questions ahead of time. I usually don't plan for. I'll write down a few notes and I'll decide. I'll think really hard about where I want to start. Like, what's the first question I want to ask? But I try not to create in my head. I find for me that if I write out 10 questions, I instinctively sort of use it as a crutch, and then always I'm trying to push the conversation back to the questions that I'd written down ahead of time. And usually that, more often than not, that's not really the direction that the interviewee wants to go. Or it's most of the time the questions that I'm going to write down end up just being the questions that they're probably getting asked in every interview they do. Whereas if we kind of just kind of let the show or the conversation follow, or let our curiosities guide the conversation, it tends to be better and they tend to have more energy than if they kind of feel like it's just a sort of rote interview where I'm just, all right, next question, you know, moving on. That I think a lot of times guests who do a lot of media for something like a book that they wrote or some project they're doing or something, they feel that and they kind of get tired of it. And when you allow that, when you kind of purposefully allow space for the rabbit trail, interviewees tend to like that, I think. Because they have to be a little bit more creative and on their toes.
Yeah, well, and can say something a little different than the last 10 interviews.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's right. Stringfellow Barr, who was a tutor at St. John's College for years, had these 9 rules of good dialectic or dialogue, and one of them was his rule of bedlam, that a really good seminar sometimes was indistinguishable from chaos. I agree with that. I think that the best classes and the best podcasts we've had is when, you know, Jason will occasionally ask, where's the bedlam? You know, when's it going to, you can't manufacture it. It just happens. And yet it's wonderful when it does. So I promised a little bit of time for you at the end here to kind of give us a quick survey of what Searcy's offering. You know me, I'm good friends with your father and I'm happy to serve. I do hardly anything, but I sit on the board of Searcy. And so I have a lot of ties to what Searcy's doing and benefit a lot myself from the podcasts that I know you're kind of in the middle of getting out there. So I wanted to give you just a few minutes. Give us a sense of what all is out there for the listener if they want to go over to Searcy and get familiar with your podcasting.
So we have 2 sort of networks, the way we look at it. One is just called the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. That's where we keep most of our stuff that is generally more related to education. So we have a podcast for homeschooling moms called The Mason Jar, with kind of a Charlotte Mason-y bent to that. But, you know, we have podcasts like that, for example. We've got Ask Andrew, where my dad is in 15 to 20 minute increments answering periodically specific questions about classical education and the ideas and terms that are sort of essential to it. So people will send in questions and he'll answer them. We have a podcast called The Commons that's led by Brian Phillips, and that's often about leadership, specifically in schools and homeschool co-ops and things like that, like school leadership from a teacher and say a, you know, headmasters and even boards from that perspective. So anything related more to education and pedagogies and the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. And then we also have our Close Reads Podcast Network. About 4 years ago, we launched a literature podcast called Close Reads, where me and a couple of friends, we get on there and we discuss books pretty slowly. We'll do anywhere from 5 to 9 weeks on a specific novel or book. Right now we're doing 12 weeks on The Odyssey, going 2 books at a time for the most part. So that started about 4 years ago. And out of that grew a show called The Plays the Thing. And that's where we're going through Shakespeare one act at a time. We've got our Daily Poem podcast where me and occasionally people who fill in for me just read a poem, offer a few brief comments on the poem, and then read it again. That's every weekday, and it's, you know, meant to be 5 to 8 minutes long, just something to add to your morning commute, or sometimes people use that for their morning time with their kids or even at bedtime. I've discovered people are doing that. We also have a podcast that I do called Libromania. And that's just a podcast for book nerds. I'll interview biographers about famous authors, the stories behind famous books, or you know, crazy stories about books. Did an episode, for example, on the Confederacy of Dunces, the story behind that and how that got published. I'll talk to book critics, book designers. I've talked to some famous cover designers, for example, different stuff like that. So if it's related to sort of book nerddom, that's what that podcast is for. We've got a bunch of other things. So if you want to, you know, you can just search for Searcy Institute in whatever podcast app you you listen in. You can search for the names, but if you just search Searcy or Close Reads, almost anything will show up. And all those related to each other podcasts will show up there. Show up there as well. And we do have 4 or 5 new shows coming this fall and winter that we're really excited about, including a podcast, which I think I can say this publicly. We have a podcast about the Roman emperors coming out soon, and I don't want to say too much more about that, but that's going to tell the stories of the Roman emperors, and that'll be out this fall. So things like that coming down the line. Hopefully Josh Gibbs, who writes for us, he's going to have one. Can't make any other announcements on too much stuff, but those are some things that we have coming down the pipe. So we're excited. And you can go to just whatever app you're using, search for that, or you can go to CerseiInstitute.com and click under the media tab. We've got a podcast network button there, and that takes you to the page with all the podcasts. So we have lots of interviews of various kinds. Have our Forma podcast, which is the audio companion to our journal, our quarterly journal called Forma. And me and our managing editor, Heidi White, interview different people about different topics related to the intersection between contemporary culture and classical education, classical thought. So this week's episode, for example, Heidi interviewed a poet and translator named A.E. Stallings, who has a new, she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for her most recent collection of poetry last year. And she also has a translation of Hesiod out. So lots of stuff in that kind of intersection on that podcast. So if you just head to the website, you can find out about, you know, get descriptions and see all the most recent episodes and find out how to subscribe and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's exciting to hear what you're doing, and a little exhausting as well. You are a podcasting monster, but I appreciate all that you do. I do enjoy the Libromania is for me like it wasn't special ordered by me or anything. I've already mentioned my connections to Searcy. I didn't talk to anybody about how much I'd like that podcast, but it's like perfect for me. I really appreciate what you guys
thank
do. There.
Thank you.
And we hope that all of you listening seek as much support, conversation, and help as you can. Education's probably one of the hardest things we almost all of us attempt to do in some way as parent or teacher or boss or human. We try to help others find the truth and find happiness thereby. And any help we can get from anyone like David or anyone else is deeply appreciated. Till next time. Likewise. Thank you, David, for coming. And
of course.
Hope we can have you back for some other interesting conversation in the future. And appreciate the time you've given us today.
Of course. Thank you very much.